What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. Delighted to have you with us on this Tuesday afternoon. Our program is for our non-Catholic listeners, and we know that there's a lot of you folks who have questions about the Catholic faith. Maybe you don't know who else to ask. Well, you can certainly ask us. And here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. If you like texting, you can text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response. Once you get it, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can always send us an email, the address for that, ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro is our producer. Vanessa is handling the phones. Rich is on social media. If you'd like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, we're streaming on both those platforms right now. Look, I'm waving at you. All you have to do is put your question in the comments box, and then Rich will see that. He'll shoot it to us here in the studio, and we're halfway there already. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I'm well. I'm glad to be back with you.
We're so glad to have you back.
You know, I think it was maybe food poisoning.
That's awful.
I'm not sure what it was, but it was like, you're not going anywhere there, big boy. You're going back to bed.
Oh, yuck.
But today, it's a new day, and I'm very glad about that. Got a personal message for you.
Okay.
This is from Sean, who says, David, last week you were mentioning how you and your wife had found Gordon Lightfoot's song Approaching Lavender so meaningful. Normally, I prefer original artists to covers, but there is one Gordon Lightfoot song covered by Glenn Campbell, wherein the cover is actually better than the original. The song is called The Last Time I Saw Her Face. I hope you and Jill will enjoy hearing it. Peace and blessings. Sean, are you familiar with that version?
No, I've got to go check that out. I really appreciate that.
Because there was a Roberta Flack song with a similar title, The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face. And he's saying, this one is The Last Time I Saw Her Face. So he's writing it down, Sean.
Okay.
So there you go. Here's a question now from Tom in St. Louis. Dr. Anders, a colleague at church indicated that Christ's actual name given by birth was Yeshua ben Yosef. Is this correct? And if so, how and when did that get changed to Jesus Christ? Thanks for your show and your erudite answers, Tom in St. Louis.
Okay, it never got changed. It never got changed.
Ah.
And his disciples would have known him by that name. Now, they would have addressed him by other titles as well. You know, their preferred title for him was Rabbi.
Okay.
That's how they often spoke. Actually, I don't know if we have an instance of them addressing him by his first name. I don't think there's any instance of them going, yo, Yeshua, yeah, what do you think about this? It was always Rabbi or Lord,
right,
or something.
Yeah.
Okay. But you know, the charge written against him at the crucifixion used his given name, which was written, we know, in Hebrew, Aramaic, and in Greek. So they would have used the Aramaic form of that as well.
All right.
Christ is not his last name. Christ is not his last name. Christ is a title. Christ is a title. It means anointed one. It is the Greek form of the Hebrew from which we get the word Messiah, and it just means anointed one. And a lot of characters in the Old Testament are anointed as signs of divine authority. Prophets and kings and priests were anointed. And the anointed, the Lord's anointed, right, came to be a messianic title, the expectation that there would be a Davidic king who would come rule over Israel and liberate her from her enemies. And so the Christ, in common parlance, or the Messiah, meant that individual, right?
Okay.
And so, you know, Jesus, that guy, Joseph's putative son, yeah, he's that. He's that Messiah character, right? It's kind of like, you know, calling somebody the president. Well, you know, if you call somebody the president, you didn't change their name. You're just indicating their title or their role or office.
The is not his first name.
The is not his first name, exactly.
Very good. And thanks so much, Tom in St. Louis, for your...
Oh, and Jesus is just the English version of the Greek version of the Aramaic Yeshua.
There it is. And we have this question here from Kyle. Why isn't it a mortal or venial sin to smoke a cigarette? Also, is growing marijuana and smoking it permissible?
Okay, thanks. I appreciate the question. So you can scan textbooks of Catholic moral theology and read encyclicals all day long, and you will not find, I don't think, a paragraph on the morality of smoking, right or wrong, okay? And to be sure, there are lots of Catholics that have smoked in the past and continue to smoke, although fewer today, I think, than in previous centuries.
Uh-huh.
There are priests that I have known that have smoked, and some quite a lot. I imagine, I don't know this for a fact, but I imagine there have been not a few popes that smoked over the years, right? Don't know any, I don't think the current pope smokes. He's a tennis player, you know. John Paul II was a skier, an alpinist, you know.
Yes.
He was a skier, so I think he was probably in pretty good shape. But
yes.
I imagine over the history there have been smoking popes. And I once put this question in a kind of playful way to two men that I respected, two clerics. One actually, well, I just put it this way, was highly ranked in the church.
Okay.
And one was highly ranked in reputation, the other in office. And the question I put to them was, okay, august clerical personage, tell me whether you think it is immoral, and listen carefully to the way I framed the question, whether it is immoral for a person today to take up the habit of smoking.
Ah.
I didn't ask, is it immoral in a kind of objectively absolute way for all time? Because clearly, for most of human history, most of the history of smoking, people had no reason to suspect that smoking was bad for them.
Right. Right?
That is a recent discovery in human history.
Mm.
And many of the priests that I have known that have been smokers took the habit up before it was widely understood how damaging it was. So I think they're in a different moral boat from someone who takes it up today knowing that it causes cancer and will shorten their life, okay? Question was, is it wrong to take up the habit? And one of these two august clerics said, absolutely wrong.
Yeah.
The other one said, no, not wrong.
Wow.
Interestingly, the one who said, yes, absolutely wrong was the ex-smoker. The no, it's not wrong was the never-smoker. Now, I want to interpret their answers on the other side of the break because it's interesting about Catholic moral theology.
This is fascinating. So we'll continue that, Kyle. Stick with us. We also have lines open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call now. It is Call to Communion. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. There's a couple lines that are open for you right now. It is not too late to call. So before the break, we were talking about this very interesting question that Kyle sent in. Why isn't it a mortal or venial sin to permit smoking, or to smoke a cigarette, rather, and is growing marijuana and smoking it permissible?
Yeah, so before the break, I told a funny little story, true story, about asking two different clerics about the morality of taking up the habit of smoking. And one said, oh, it'd be immoral to take up. And the other had the opposite opinion, right?
Right, right.
Interestingly, the anti-smoker was the ex-smoker, and the permissive smoker was the non-smoker, right?
Okay.
Now, when you dig into it, it's an interesting reason, I think, why these priests answered in different ways. The fellow who said it would be definitely immoral was very, very well grounded in Thomism, a theological, philosophical school within Catholic theology that really weighs heavily on the idea of natural law, right? That what makes a thing to be right or wrong is that it either facilitates or frustrates human flourishing in a very robust kind of way. Now, most of human history, we would not have known that smoking was an impediment to human flourishing. Now, it's very clear. It's irrational, and I think I can say this without any difficulty. It is irrational to smoke.
It is.
It's irrational to smoke. We know that. And according to St. Thomas, the rule of human acts is right reason. And so for that reason, it would be immoral to take up the habit. Now, The other priest, less schooled in Thomism, probably operating under some different moral theories about what makes acts right or wrong within the history of the Catholic tradition, mm-hmm. a little bit more casuistic, a little bit more based on probable opinion. And since smoking priests have a long history in the Catholic Church, right? There are a lot of smoking priests historically, would have been more inclined to say, well, this has been allowed in the past, and therefore the probable opinion is that it could be justified in the future. So different moral theories cashed out. Now, about the growing marijuana, I realize that opinions are divided on this, and this is a highly charged ideological debate, okay? My personal conviction, and look, I'm not a scientist, and I'm not a doctor, and I'm not a pharmacologist, and I'm not an herbologist or anything like that, but my personal opinion is I don't think that marijuana affords much for human flourishing. Despite whatever alleged medical benefits it might have in isolated cases, I think on balance, it's not good for the human person. Because I think most people who engage in it at the very least are aiming at some form of intoxication, which is diminishing reason. And to choose to check out from your own rationality, I think is, well, an irrational thing to do. And there are other obvious downsides to it. I mean, the risk of psychosis goes up and a number of other risk factors that come in. I mean, it's just not, I don't think it's a good thing to do on balance for people to engage in marijuana use. I realize there are others who have, different thoughts about that. And obviously the legal status of the thing across the states varies. And there are some regimes where it's clearly illegal. And obviously the Catholic Church tells you to obey civil law.
Right, right.
And so you don't want to do anything that's against the law, even if it would otherwise be morally permissible. Mm-hmm. But even in those regimes where it is permitted legally, my personal view is I think there's some issues there with human flourishing. I won't say where, but I was traveling cross country a while back and I went through, Alabama does not have the same legal regime. It's not nearly as permissive about the use of marijuana as some neighboring states. And I was traveling through a neighboring state that has more permissive views on this thing. And there was a billboard on the side of the road advertising medical marijuana.
Yeah.
Let me just say that no tie-dyed 70s psychedelic rock band could possibly have marketed this medicinal product with more paisley psychedelia, right? I mean, it was evident to me they're not marketing this as a medicinal product, right? that is a subterfuge. Their market, their audience for this is people who want they want a justification, right, to engage in self-intoxication. And that's not, I'm not saying everybody does that, but that was clearly what was in view in this one particular advertisement.
Very good. Thanks so much for your question, Kyle. And if you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. We're going to begin with Philip in Milwaukee, listening on the Great Spirit Catholic Radio. Philip actually has a question related to what we were just talking about. Philip, what's on your mind today?
Well, I believe he basically answered it, but I was an altar boy in 1960, and the priest smoked. And I didn't smoke because of them, but here's my problem. 2 years ago, I find out it's immoral, it's bad. Oh, what the heck, I'm addicted 60-some years already, and I can't quit.
Yes. Thank you, Philip. I really appreciate the call. So you'll notice I discussed this question a little bit in the previous call, but I distinguished. I said, let's look at two different cases. There's a guy like Philip who started smoking 60 years ago before we knew how bad it was for us.
Yeah.
And then there's maybe somebody who's, 25 who wants to take up the habit today. I don't think those people are in morally equivalent situations.
Right, right.
And you're absolutely correct. I mean, your body has developed I'm going to put this in quotes here, a kind of physiological need for tobacco. And you can have, it's very, very difficult to give up. I know a case of a woman who was, basically pushing her 90s, who had been smoking 2 packs of unfiltered Camels a day.
Whoa.
For like 70 years. And she said, I think I'd better give this up. And so she quit. She immediately broke out into hives. And she went to the doctor and she's like, I'm trying to give up smoking, but look what happens to me. I'm totally breaking out in hives. And the doctor looked at her and said, woman, you're 90 years old. Light them up. Smoke. Smoke. you've you know, actuarially, smoking will cut 15 years off your life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily cut 15 years off everyone's life, just the average, right? This woman had made it to 90. She'd already beaten the averages by 15 years in the other direction.
She beat the Reaper.
She beat the Reaper, exactly. You know, and yeah, so yeah, I don't think you're in the same moral position as, say, you know, like me. I don't smoke. I actually did when I was in high school.
Did you?
I did, and because everybody around me did, and yeah. You know, all the guys smoked Camels and all the girls smoked Marlboros. That's how it was.
Wow.
You know, and I kind of just went around with the crowd, and I got to college, and I was walking up the stairs to my dorm one day, and I hacked up half a lung. And I was like, you know, this isn't good for me, man. This is not good for me. So I quit. I quit smoking, alcohol, caffeine, everything right there, cold turkey, age 18.
Wow.
Really irritated my smoking roommate because I'd signed up for a smoking room, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And got in shape and got over it. I did go back to caffeine. I have to admit that. But I never went back to smoking.
Fascinating. Philip, thanks so much for your call. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to Communion on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN. Very quick parenthetical aside here for you. And listeners of a certain age will know what I'm talking about here. My parents were both big-time smokers.
Okay.
And one day in whatever that was, 1962, 63, the two of them are sitting watching the Huntley-Brinkley Report, which was the hot newscast before Walter Cronkite took over. And Chet Huntley said, the Surgeon General today said da-da-da-da-da-da, all about smoking and the problems with cancer and all that. And my dad said, oh, okay. Set down the cigarettes, never picked them up the rest of his life. My mother sees the same newscast, and she's going, nah, I'll just keep going. And it eventually got to her.
My grandfather did the same thing, and it was before the Surgeon General. Sometime in the 40s or 50s,
yeah,
he just
yeah.
said, you know, I don't think this stuff's good for me. And he put him down and never came back.
Wow, amazing. Let's go to Eldon now, a first-time caller from Canada. All right, and he is listening on the EWTN app. Eldon, what's on your mind today, sir?
Oh, I was on this an interesting conversation because you got two theologians saying opposite of whether or not it's moral or immoral to smoke nowadays, but I just thought it was interesting. My dad was born in 1929, and he basically smoked ever since he was like 10 years old, and right up until he was 80 and then he quit cold turkey. But it was always interesting. My mom never smoked at all. She always said that he'll be the death of her, but he smoked like a Jimmy. He smoked cigarettes, but he primarily smoked tobacco for most of his life, or at height for most of his life
uh-huh.
there.
Uh-huh.
But then he ended up in the latter part. He lost all his teeth, so he couldn't hold his pipe, and he rolled his pipe tobacco up in cigarette wrappers and smoked that for the last part of his life there. But then 2 years before he died, he decided he doesn't want to smoke anymore, so he stopped cold turkey. But I always thought it was amazing that he had in his cabin at the lake a sign that said it's better to smoke here than in the hereafter.
Ooh.
Hmm.
Wow.
Well, you know, I don't disagree with that judgment.
No, that's a...
But I'm not sure the one... necessarily helps you avoid the other, you know?
No, no.
So I think learning temperance in all areas of our lives is probably better preparation for the hereafter.
All areas. Eldon, thanks so much for checking in from Canada. By the way, he was pointing out there that he was listening to us on the EWTN app. You know, we are everywhere. EWTN is everywhere. One of our platforms is the MyTuner app, where you can listen to EWTN Radio's live stream. If you've got it, open up the MyTuner app, search EWTN, and you will find it. Let's go to Kelly now. Kelly is a first-time caller from New Hampshire, listening online, EWTN.com. Hello, Kelly. What's on your mind today?
Hi. I'm wondering if either of you have had the chance to make the Moody Blues reference today for Tuesday afternoon.
Not yet, but I got to do it. Yeah, well, you know, it's a side two, cut one, I'm pretty sure.
Uh-huh.
And so we will eventually get to it. What's on your mind today, Kelly?
I love the show. Thank you for all you do. I am an adult convert to Catholicism. I grew up playing the organ in a Protestant church. And when I go back out to the Midwest to visit family, I sometimes play for services.
Uh-huh.
Is it legit for me to do that?
Yeah, yeah. Thanks. I appreciate the call, Kelly. Yeah, sure. It's legit. It's legit. You know, there are a lot of Catholic musicians who, surprise, surprise, can't make a living just playing in Catholic institutions.
No.
Can you believe that?
Shocking.
Unbelievable, right?
Yeah.
And so they have to take gigs where they can get them. And a lot of times that's going to mean also playing in Protestant services. And I've known the traffic to go the other way as well. I know Protestants that play the organ in Catholic services because, hey, you know, they got to keep the lights on.
Yeah.
You know, your motive here is not purely financial, but it's familial, and you're trying to bond with people that you used to go to church with or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And look, you know, the ends of ecumenism are met by affirming the things that we have in common. And, you know, I think one of the most beautiful things that we have in common is a Protestant by the name of Johann Sebastian Bach.
Yes.
I mean, like, he is the patrimony of the human race, man. Can't we all get together on Bach?
You know?
And so I think that's delightful. Now, you know, where I would issue a caution is I have known cases of Catholics, especially young Catholics, who figure out that, you know, they can go play in the Lutheran church to keep the lights on, and they start doing more and more of those gigs, and they start going to Mass less and less and less, and the next thing you know, they've just settled in comfortably to their Protestant world. And it's not really a matter of conviction. It's just been one of convenience because that's where they spend all their musical life. So, yeah, they got to watch out for that.
Okay.
And don't go to communion. Don't go to communion
right.
in the Protestant church.
Exactly. And we won't even mention altar call, will we?
No.
We won't mention. Kelly, thanks so much for your call from New Hampshire. Here's a question now. This is from Kevin watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Dr. Anders, is it wrong for a Catholic to attend Protestant services in addition to Catholic Mass?
Yeah, well, we kind of touched on that right in the last call. But here I think the motive might be different. This is somebody who's asking not because they've been asked to play the organ, but maybe they're accompanying a Protestant spouse.
Yeah.
Or maybe they're just seeking edification, right? And here, I really think it comes down to A, your motive, and B, your safety.
Mm-hmm.
So what do I mean by that? Okay, like I grew up in the Protestant church, and I went to Protestant college and Protestant seminary, and I got a PhD in Protestant theology, and I know the tradition very well, and I know darn well why I left it. I'm in no confusion in my own mind about why I left Protestantism and became Catholic. There are things I like about Protestantism, you know, Protestant friends I have, there's some things I admire in their theological tradition, but there's some really solid reasons that I left, and those are not going to change. And so I myself have attended a couple Protestant churches since being Catholic for two distinct reasons. One is if I'm attending someone else's, you know, quasi-sacramental event, whether it be their, you know, their marriage or whatever, their baptism would be a genuine sacramental event, and I'm trying to celebrate them in their tradition. The other reason would be purely sociological or anthropological, right? So there are a couple churches around town that, you know, have a pretty heavy growth rate. I have no interest in joining that crowd. I'm not going to add my name to the rolls.
Yeah.
But I've gone and sort of sat in the back and gone, okay, what is it that's attracting people to this congregation? Particularly like if I know ex-Catholics that have wandered over there, I'm like, okay, what are they seeing here? And you know, what could I help my church, my Catholic church, understand about why this might be appealing to somebody who's on the edge? And so I'm like doing homework, you know?
Yeah.
One thing I've really not ever done since becoming Catholic is seek out what I might call edification from the insights of a Protestant preacher, right?
Mm.
Because I think that their fundamental theological position is wrong. You know, I mean, they might have some interesting anecdotes about human nature, but their fundamental premise about how they think you relate to God and the world, I just think is incorrect. And so I'm not going to try to be edified that way.
Kevin, thanks so much for checking us out on YouTube this afternoon. In a moment, Elma in Washington State. Couple lines open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to communion on this Tuesday afternoon, side two, cut one, on EWTN. Do stay with us. It's Call to Communion. Glad that you're with us. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. Dr. David Anders here to answer your questions, particularly for those of you who are not Catholic, to get some clarity in your mind as to why does the Catholic Church teach this and it doesn't teach this over here. So again, that phone number, 833-288-EWTN. Congratulations going out to a couple of our great EWTN radio partners, both celebrating 10 years with us, working with our friends at Real Presence Radio, KZEB, serving Jamestown, North Dakota, also KXYM, serving Belcourt, North Dakota. Congratulations to Mary Jeffrey at Hope and Truth Radio, also David Bryan at Two Hearts Radio, from your friends here at EWTN. Let's go to Washington State now and talk with Elma, listening to us on the EWTN app. Hello, Elma. What's on your mind today?
Hi. I was curious about the Catholic teaching on, just because we were talking about the marijuana use, if it was to be, I mean, apart from it being illegal in some places in the U.S., what would be the view on using microdosing psychedelics if it were to help treat, if there was scientific evidence that it would help treat trauma?
Sure, sure. So let me draw an analogy to another controlled substance, okay? If you go and have a surgical procedure today, you know, you could go get a colonoscopy. You could go have, you know, any number of invasive procedures that require you to be anesthetized. It is not at all uncommon for anesthesiologists to administer fentanyl because that's what it was designed for. It was designed for surgical use, you know, in very restrictive cases. And the people who are being administered this, along with another cocktail of drugs to anesthetize them, are not experiencing the effects that drug abusers have when they use fentanyl. Now, if you ask DEA agents, you know, what is one of the biggest problem drugs in the United States today? They're going to tell you fentanyl, right? And the abuse of that drug for personal intoxication is just absolutely devastating at every level, right? Would the Catholic Church have a problem with an anesthesiologist administering fentanyl to someone who's receiving a colonoscopy? No, they wouldn't, right? Would they have a problem with someone using fentanyl because they wanted to self-medicate, quote-unquote, by becoming deliriously intoxicated on an opiate of immense power? Yeah, they'd have a big problem with that, okay? And, you know, the Church obviously does not have a catalog that issues authoritative moral judgments on every pharmacological product, you know, produced by every pharmaceutical company. That's cumbersome and impossible, right? What they do is they have principles, and it's up to confessors and penitents to apply their moral judgments, applying the general principles to particular cases. Here's a general principle. Don't seek out intoxication for its own sake. Don't seek out intoxication for its own sake. That's a pretty clear principle, okay?
Yeah.
Now, are there drugs that have intoxicating qualities that might have, you know, legitimate therapeutic uses? Well, you know, I understand what the speculation is on this, and I know the state of the cultural conversation. Obviously, from a scientific point of view, that's way beyond my pay grade. I mean, the Catholic Church also says we have a moral obligation to be rational. And I think it's pretty settled conviction, pretty strong consensus here, that it is not rational to pretend expertise that you do not have, right? And expert opinion on these kinds of things has to be sought to form a rational, objective judgment, even if you're a conspiracy theorist who thinks that, you know, the establishment is all in the hands of the bad guys. Like, we still aren't going to do better than expert scientific opinion. And so my position would be the rational thing, and therefore the morally correct thing to do, would be to try to follow the preponderance of evidence, non-ideologically driven research about what actually is going to tend to human flourishing. Now, this is a question, the question you raised, is nearly impossible to disentangle from ideology, right? Because if you know anything about the history of drug use in the United States, you know it's entangled with all kinds of quasi-religious and ideological motives, right? So I strongly believe in research, but I also believe that researchers can pursue an agenda.
Elma, thanks so much for your excellent call from Washington State. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Marianne. She is in San Antonio listening on the Guadalupe Network. Hi, Marianne. What's on your mind today?
Hi, fine. How are you?
Doing very well.
Is this the cough? Can you hear, or am I on the...
You are on the air. What's on your mind today, Marianne?
Okay. Today, what's on my mind is I've been listening to the people about, you know, Protestant versus Catholic and several things. I thought that was the topic, but it's kind of jumping around. But I know, I just told them, I know what made my three daughters leave the Catholic Church and become Protestants, for one, a Lutheran, and the truth is, it's because they don't want to go to confession, and they don't believe that you should have to go to confession, and it kind of sugarcoats it into thinking that God died for their sins, past, present, and future, period. There's no in-between. You don't have to be good anymore, and you don't have to change your ways or repent. It's just a lot of that is what my daughter's been hearing at her church, and it's pretty sad. It breaks my heart, but, and you know, it's just that they just don't want to feel guilty or obligated to conform to a beautiful, to the Catholic Church, which is the true church, as far as I'm concerned. So.
Yeah, thank you. I profoundly appreciate the question. I mean, the comment, and I completely understand, and I have heard such testimonies countless times. Right? If you look at the sociological data on people who leave Catholicism, and this is something that I've been a keen student of for some time. The number one reason that people give for leaving the Catholic Church is quite pedestrian, and it's very understandable. They say they left the church because they felt like their spiritual needs were not being met. And I take that charge very seriously, and I think that when people say that, it means that there has been some pastoral failure in their case, that the church did something wrong in that particular person's instance. The church failed to make the faith relevant to that individual, and that is the job of pastoral theology. Right, the job of pastoral theology is to take the truths of the faith and apply them to the concrete circumstances of human lives such that the people involved can be brought to a transformative knowledge of God that changes their life for the better. And there's nothing wrong with the theology of the Catholic Church, but sometimes there are serious deficits in its pastoral application. And so every time somebody leaves, you know, my default judgment is not to point the finger at the person leaving going bad, 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 bad. But to ask the question, okay, where was there a pastoral failure in this person's case? Now, what you've described from your daughters, and I'm going to read between the lines here, so forgive me if I don't get this exactly right, is that they experienced the church as moralistic and judgmental. And that didn't do anything for them. And so they went the opposite to some place where they were told, well, you know, you have no moral judgment because you have no moral responsibility. You're saved by faith alone. And that was a kind of antidote to the moralism and what they perceived as the judgmentalism of the Catholic Church. Okay, now, what do I think about that? I don't think Catholicism should be presented as moralistic or judgmental. And I think that based on the example of my Lord, that the only people that I can see that Jesus was judgmental with were religious hypocrites who thought they had it all together. That's who Jesus was judgmental with. With the rest of the world, the people who were, you know, living their hard lives and trying to get along, but maybe were a bit alienated from the mainstream because they'd fallen into sin or had bad habits or wrong associations, and they were suffering for it. With those, Jesus was nothing but infinite compassion. And he went and had dinner with them. And they broke bread together. So much so that the people who felt like they had it all together accused Jesus of being a drunkard, a glutton, and a friend of sinful people. How many of us Catholics who think we have it all together frequently suffer from the accusation that we're friends with sinful people? Shame, shame, shame. Right?
Yeah.
And, you know, what the data show is that when you join a new religious community, could be Catholic, could be something else, if you get deeply involved in that, you know, after a certain number of years, all of your friends tend to be your co-religionists. And not only your co-religionists, but the segment of your church that thinks and behaves and acts and believes and worships and, you know, like you do. And I think few of us will fall prey to the same accusations they made against our Lord, right? And, you know, the late Pope Francis made a big deal about the need of the church to go outside its comfort zone and accompany people, be present to people in their need, in their poverty, in their loneliness, in their alienation, not to be complicit in their sin, but to be present with them in the circumstances of their lives that would drive them to sin. You know what the strongest predictors of drug abuse are? Poverty, homelessness, broken families, you know, experiences of discrimination. These are the kind of conditions, the brokenness of human life that drives people to these self-destructive practices.
People who are hurting.
People who are hurting, exactly. And when the church fails to be present in charity to people that are hurting, well, of course, they're going to go elsewhere.
Yeah. Marianne, thanks so much for your call. We hope that is helpful for you, and really appreciated that phone call from San Antonio. It's called Communion here on EWTN. If you're up early in the morning, have we got a show for you? Fathers Know Best. I'm not talking about, Jim Anderson and his family, Lauren Chapin and all them. No, no, no. Fathers Know Best. That is Monday through Friday mornings, 4 o'clock Eastern on EWTN Radio. Drawing from our rich library, we bring you great retreat teachings, lectures, exclusive programs hosted by priests that you know and trust, like Father Larry Richards, Father John Ricardo, Father Benedict Rochelle. It is so good. Fathers Know Best. Monday through Friday mornings, every weekday, 4 a.m. Eastern, right here on EWTN Radio. Let's go to Bob now in Montevideo, Minnesota, listening on the great Real Presence Radio. Hello, Bob. What's on your mind today, sir?
Well, first, I have to confess the sin of lying. I had to pretend to be someone else to get on the show because I spent my question last week. But anyways, this show was so pertinent to me that I had to call in. First, I got to point out about smoking. I don't know if you remember it, but about 20 years ago, the oldest woman in the world was from Arles, France, and actually knew the, who was the painter who cut his ear off and sent it to a prostitute? Anyways, she was like 114.
Oh, Fulton Sheen. Fulton Sheen, yeah.
Yeah. And, and they asked her why. She said, well, I was afraid I might drop my cigarette and start a fire. The other thing that's pertinent is I'm a liturgical musician, and a few months back I called in with a crazy question. Is the Catholic Church the only one that believes that marriage is a sacrament? And, of course, the Orthodox, too. And the reason I asked that was because I used to play weddings all over the place in all these different churches. And then a friend of mine who's a Lutheran theologian, he invited me, I hadn't seen him in decades, to go and to visit his place, and I wanted to discuss the sacrament of marriage because reading theology of the body and whatnot, and he was raised Missouri Lutheran. He said, nope, it's not a sacrament. And my jaw just dropped. And he said, because Luther went back and looked, and he said, the only ones that are sacraments are baptism and communion. And I wanted to point out with him, but I was so shocked I couldn't do it. In Scripture, you can correct me if I'm wrong, the only one of the seven sacraments of the Catholic Church that is directly referred to as a sacrament, mysterion in the Greek, is the sacrament of marriage. It becomes sacramentum through Tertullian sacrament.
Okay. Yeah, so I can speak to that. So you're absolutely correct about the Lutheran tradition, the Calvinist tradition were emphatic that marriage not be counted as a sacrament. Now, to their credit, I think they're dead wrong about that, but let me get something into the exegetical question you just raised. It is not clear that mysterion in Koine Greek or sacramentum in the Vulgate Latin refer in the text of Scripture specifically to what we mean in sacramental theology when we say the word sacrament or sacramentum, right? In Greek, the word mysterion means something that was previously hidden that has now been revealed.
Okay.
That's what the word means. Okay. And so the paradigm use, Paul refers to the gospel as a mysterion, a mystery, in that the truth of the Gentile inclusion into Christ through faith was a truth that had been hidden from the fathers of the Old Covenant, but now revealed by Christ through the apostles of the New Testament. That's the specific content that was previously hidden that's now revealed, and it's for that reason that he calls the gospel a mystery. He doesn't call it a mystery because it's hard to understand. A lot of times in modern world, in modern English, when we say mystery, we mean something hard to understand. That's not what it means in Greek. It means something previously hidden, now revealed. The gospel wasn't hard for Paul to understand, but it had been hidden before, revealed now. Now you can see why the term eventually came to be applied to the rites of the Catholic Church that we rightly call sacraments, because the sacraments conceal hidden things that have now been revealed. And there was in Christian antiquity a practice called the discipline of the secret, the disciplina arcani, that involved concealing the sacramental mysteries from catechumens and only revealing them after the Easter baptism when they were fully initiated into the church. And you really get a sense for this meaning of mystery as applied to the sacraments if you attend to the liturgy of St. John Chrysostom, which is the liturgy of the Eastern Catholic Church. The language of mystery is all through there. But again, it doesn't refer to something hard to understand. It's really referring to the mystery of these gifts that were given to us, revealed to us in Jesus. And this business about concealing them from outsiders comes across in a kind of delightful way. There's a line in the liturgy when the deacon cries out, "The doors, the doors," and he's not talking about the 60s rock band, right? it's a reference to shutting the doors of the church so that the catechumens will be excluded from the mysteries.
Ah, okay. Very good. Hey, Bob, thanks so much for your call from Montevideo. It is called a communion here on EWTN. Hey, we got an email from Queensland, Australia. This is from Lex, who says, "Hi there, Tom and Dr. David. Love your program on the EWTN app. Thanks for sharing with us your great knowledge of the faith. Here's my question. Humanity has been cursed in every generation by the original sin of Adam and Eve. I would like to ask you about your understanding of generational or family curses. I realize that Jesus, in John 9:2, replied when asked who was to blame that this man was born blind, that it was not his parents nor him that sinned to cause his blindness. However, some families seem to be under a curse by the number of bad things that happen to them continuously. Your thoughts and understanding would be most appreciated. God bless you both. Take care. Lex in Queensland, Australia."
Yes. So there is a Pentecostal theology that has been heavily circulated in Pentecostal charismatic, and I should say it's also circulated in Catholic charismatic circles.
Really?
That people are subject to demonic influence that is inherited from the sins or misdeeds of their parents, and that in order to be freed from it, certain esoteric rites are necessary, certain prayers of deliverance, maybe exorcisms, these kinds of things, in order to, you know, shake off these clinging demons that one inherited from one's past. The Catholic Association of Exorcists, you're not going to get a more authoritative reading on the ways and whys of demons in human life than that group, has declared this doctrine to be un-Catholic, untraditional, unbiblical, and that we are to have nothing to do with it, right? So this is a Pentecostal doctrine drawn from that branch of Protestantism. It's become popular in some Catholic circles, but the Catholic official position on this is that is a non-Catholic way of thinking. We are not going to go there. Okay, now, that does not mean that the sins of the parents have no effect on the children. That doesn't mean that, right? We know empirically that they do. So, you know, if you are a drug addict and you are taking heavy drugs while you're pregnant, well, do not expect your child to be spared, you know, your foolishness. It's going to have an effect on them.
Yeah.
Right? If you are an alcoholic and you're raising children in an alcoholic home, well, you know what that looks like, right? That is devastating on the lives of children. So parents' sins definitely have effect on their own morality, and their morality or lack thereof will definitely impact the upbringing of these children, but not by way of some esoteric curse or some clinging demons that have been passed down through generations. That's not the way to conceive of it.
Lex, thanks so much for your question there from Queensland, Australia. What a beautiful part of our beautiful world. Here's a question now. I'm going to call this anonymous. This person says, "I've been Catholic my entire life, but I still find it hard to let go and trust God in every aspect of life. Your thoughts on how just to trust God. I always worry about things with kids and family and my faith. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, sure. So here's something that we know. For a fact, it's both scriptural, traditional, and empirically obvious. Really bad stuff happens all the time to faithful Catholics.
Yeah.
They get cancer. Their kids get cancer. They have terrible accidents. They are the victims of horrific crimes and injustices. And they happen a lot, and they happen at cataclysmic levels that have life-stopping and life-shattering consequences, and God lets it happen. And it is the worst possible heresy, in my judgment, to suggest that we can reliably stave that off if we behave a certain way, or if we believe a certain way, or if we pray hard enough that we can reliably keep tragedy at bay. And I think that is a cruel teaching, and I have known people who hold it. And so when they suffer tragedy, they suffer twice. They suffer the tragedy, and then they suffer the tragedy of personal guilt, thinking, well, this happened because I'm not a good enough Christian. And then they are just doubly devastated. Well, Jesus attacks that head on. He said, you know, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Neither one, says Jesus, neither one, right? And so trusting God cannot mean trusting him to keep me from experiencing bad things. It cannot mean that. It has to mean something different. It has to mean trusting that when bad things happen, there's a way through this for me, that there's still hope for me, that God still loves me in spite of the appearances. That's what trusting God has to mean, right? And for me, it's helpful to realize that there's no good alternative, right? I mean, the Stoics figured this out a long time ago. There's things you can change and things you can't. Quit worrying about the things you can't change and you'll do better in life.
Yeah.
Nothing will frustrate you worse than unfulfilled expectations. So get your expectations rational. That's the Stoic view. Now, mm-hmm. If you can bring to that basic Stoic insight, which Christianity does not repudiate, right? I mean, in fact, that lies at the heart of a lot of monastic practice.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can enhance that Stoic insight with the added conviction and faith that not only can I not control certain things and therefore I shouldn't worry about them, but that everything that happens in accord with the will of a good God who cares for me, well, then that's high-octane Stoicism, if you will, Christian Stoicism, which is the right kind. And I think that's the only thing that trusting God can rationally mean for us. It's that we recognize that it is in our best interests to accept what happens to us and to accept it believing that God is good in spite of the apparent evidence to the contrary.
Thanks so much for your anonymous email. We do appreciate that. We'll probably close with this one from Joe, watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Joe says, now that we are 5 years removed from COVID, what is the view that the church has on the vaccine?
Church has no view on a vaccine, right? And you're not going to get a church pronouncement that says this or that drug is good or bad or effective or not effective or licit or not licit. You're not going to get that out of the church. And the reason why is that the church is not a pharmacy professor. The church
right.
is not a you know, public health authority. The church is not an epidemiologist. This is not its competence any more than you're going to get, you know, a theory about the distance of some faraway galaxy or you know the evolution of some moth. I mean, these are just not the church's competence. The church speaks to moral and theological realities that can guide our scientific research, that can guide our moral decision-making, things like the dignity of the human person, which has a very kind of robust sense in Catholicism, and sometimes human dignity requires us to play different elements off against one another, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to do that prudently, which takes dialogue and expertise, and the church advocates for all that way of approaching human moral dilemmas. But it's not going to give you a scientific answer to a scientific question. That's just not its competence.
Just thinking back about it, I've often said to people, you know, we'll be talking about this, you know, we as a planet will be talking about this pandemic for another 50 years. But that, you know, we have certainly experienced many things like this, and here we still are.
You know, I wrote an article for a local Catholic paper a while back when everybody was saying, follow the science, follow the science. And I said, science can never tell you what to do. Science can just tell you what might happen.
Yeah.
But to form the moral judgment, X might happen, therefore I should, require something beyond science to make that moral judgment.
Yes, indeed. Joe, thanks so much for your question via YouTube today. Dr. Andrews, David Andrews, thank you so much. Let me try that
thank
again.
Thank you, Smythe. Thank you, Smythe.
Blah, 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 blah. Dr. David Andrews, thank you.
Thank you this Tuesday afternoon.
It is a Tuesday afternoon. Thanks so much for listening to us. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow, 2 p.m. Eastern, God willing. On behalf of Pedro, Vanessa, and Rich, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Andrews. Thanks again for listening and watching. Got to work on this mouth. See you tomorrow. God bless.